group of people in the Americas is one person here in red. So precision medicine really tries to sort of personalize the way we look at the patients and the way we look at either disease or syndrome or whatever it might be, or even wellness, and try to identify all the little details about a person and use that then on an individual basis rather than on a group or disease basis in order to treat or prevent disease and in order to lead to better health, etc., etc. And it's obviously a big question whether or not precision medicine really can be applied and used for diseases. Is it a cost-effective way? Is it something that the society really can afford? And there are obviously many questions, and also when we would get into the ethical, moral, legal, etc. aspects, when we do that, any of these kind of things, it gets even more complicated. But what is really precision medicine? And the promise really is that we will be able to use advanced molecular diagnostic in order to tailor the medical management and treatment based on the individual characteristics of each patient. And if we are able to do something like this, we might be able, in particular if we talk now about disease, result in more optimized therapeutic benefits with less adverse reactions. And that's sort of the overall principle of why we believe precision medicine could be better than what currently is being done for most patient management. Whether or not that is really correct or not, that, you know, there are a lot of debates, and in some cases, in particular in cancer, we see already significant impacts, whereas in other diseases it's still questionable, and it goes back and forth, and every time we have one article saying yes, precision medicine works, and suddenly something else is coming up, but it may not be as great as people anticipated or whatever. And so that really leads then sort of to the concept that one size fits all may not be really the best strategy. And so if you go sort of how it typically was done when we were looking at patients, we really looked at it more from a disease-centric point of view. So breast cancer is breast cancer, delirium is delirium, diabetes, diabetes, or whatever. And then over time, these kind of things have changed. And for example, if you take breast cancer, at the beginning it was just breast cancer and everyone got the same treatment. Then you saw it was estrogen receptor positive negative, or two positive negative, and so on. Then we had already more targeted approaches to at least have multiple subtypes of breast cancer and different types of treatments. And now we have a potentially even more precision medicine approach where you do DNA sequencing. For example, you have companies like Foundation Medicine or so doing a test, and then they can identify maybe mutations in genes that are not typically associated with breast cancer, but that would impact management of patients and would suggest, for example, a therapy using a leukemia drug on a breast cancer patient based on these type of mutations that have been identified in one particular patient. And that's sort of probably the most precise way to treat someone, and obviously it's difficult then even to design clinical trials because it becomes sort of these, what people talk now, N-of-1 type clinical trials where you don't really have any control or etc. But we definitely are sort of switching from the disease-centric approach to a more patient-centric approach, where we say instead of one size fits all, one size fits one and all, maybe multiple people, but really getting much more diversified. And how do we get to really to understand every person? So we more and more using like a multi-omics approach to try to implement precision medicine. Now we see everyone has heard of sequencing and so on, that's particularly with regard to cancer, sort of the technology being used, but there are many different other omics And I just want to give you also one example of how precision medicine really is starting to have a clinical impact, and that's for example with regard to lung cancer, where originally it was found that the EGF receptor, the gene, leads to overexpression of a protein in a significant percentage of lung cancer patients. And then various companies developed drugs to inhibit the EGF receptor, and they ran a clinical trial, and that clinical trial was really like on the left side. It was taking a group of lung cancer patients and maybe checking if EGF receptor is overexpressed, and then just treating all of them, and they barely got through the clinical trial with positive results, so they had in the range of 20% or so responses, but 80% didn't respond, and it just barely did it, but it worked well. And then the question was, why only 20% respond and 80% didn't respond? And then various additional follow-up studies, in particular also at the MGH and Dana-Farber and various other academic centers, identified actually that there are various mutations in either the EGF receptor gene or KRAS and NRAS that actually determine whether or not someone responds. And so if you have wild-type EGF receptor, there was actually no response. If you had a mutation in the EGF receptor, you were responding if KRAS and NRAS were wild-type, but if both of them were mutated, then again you didn't have a response or even shorter survival. And so you really end up now, and nowadays everyone going on a on treatment with the EGF receptor inhibitor in both lung cancer as well as colon cancer will have first the sequencing being performed in order to determine the EGF receptor KRAS and NRAS mutation, and only this particular subset of patients will be treated with this drug, whereas all the others will not. So this is a very clear-cut evidence where we can then go from 20% to maybe 60, 80, or 90% response rate, and also save a lot of healthcare costs, because this treatment costs between $50,000 to $100,000 per patient, or even more depending on where it is done. So it's a matter of saving money, not treating patients who will not benefit and probably will have even adverse reactions, and really focusing only on the patients that will benefit from a particular therapy. So how can we use now precision medicine potentially for delirium? And I just want to go first through sort of what are all these different kind of multi-omics approaches that we could use. So if you go from the genome to the epigenome, which is particular methylation of DNA, then you get to the transcriptome, which are all the different RNAs, from messenger RNA to microRNA to long non-coding RNA, circular RNAs now, etc., etc. So multiple different RNAs. That, and then obviously we go to the proteins that are being translated from the RNA, and proteins have also post-translation modifications such as phosphorylation. And then we end up with metabolites and the lipids, and in principle, if you combine all these things together, you end up with the particular disease such as, or the phenotype such as delirium, and obviously you have impact of environmental factors, mind-body impacts, and interestingly also more and more we know now about the microbiome playing a significant role in the disease development and progression of many different types of diseases. We don't know anything yet about delirium, but I'm sure it will be studied soon also. So we have now within both the program project grant, the SAGES grant, as well as in the R1 where we study multi-omics, and there's other grants that are pending or being funded. We are focusing on multiple of these different omics platforms, in particular the proteome, the lipidome, and the metabolome, in order to better understand delirium pathophysiology and identify potential biomarkers as well as therapeutic targets related to delirium. So I want to go into a little bit of the studies. I don't know if the SAGES study has been already described in previous talks, but so this is a study that's now, what is it, 8 years old or seven?
Seven
years old. Anyway, so Sharon is obviously spearheading it with a whole SAGES study team, several people here are in the room. And the study involved 560 patients that were all older than 70 years old. They did not have dementia when they enrolled into the study, and they all had elective non-cardiac surgery, primarily orthopedic surgeries. Plasma was collected at four different time points, before surgery, then at PACU, then at postoperative day two, and 1 month after surgery. And so we had four plasma samples for each patient, and then a matched case control design was developed that took six different matching factors into consideration, and we ended up with this matched case control study that overall had 75 different pairs of patients included in it out of these 560 total patients, where we had a 24% delirium rate. So what we were interested to understand whether or not we can identify potential biomarkers for risk, disease management, and also understanding the pathophysiology of delirium pathogenesis. And we used various both targeted and untargeted omics approaches to identify candidate biomarkers. To go into more detail also, in addition to the SAGES study, we are also now looking at several other studies, and we have actually also this program project then pending, where we, if it gets funded, we will have the SAGES 2 study, which will enroll again new patients. So one other study is a HYPER study that was performed at the MGH, and where in addition to plasma, also CSF was collected before surgery. And then the RISE study is a study funded by the ABDF, and where we just in the middle of enrolling different patients and following them up with both all the outcome studies as well as various other ancillary studies. And what we combined both what we are already funded for and what we are planning to do is looking at the proteome, the metabolome, the lipidome, and I haven't talked before about what I would call the immunome. So this is our, in principle, single cell immunophenotyping, where we look at all different type of immune cells in the blood, but on the single cell level with regard to both the differentiation status as well as the activation status. And then we using various statistical and bioinformatics approaches as well as systems biology analysis to identify potential markers and identify pathophysiological mechanisms that can help us to potentially also identify new therapeutic targets to prevent or treat delirium and potential long-term consequences. So if we're thinking about now how can we identify biomarkers and what are really good biomarkers, what do we need in order to have a biomarker that makes sense? So first of all, we would like it to be both highly specific and highly sensitive. So it means it should have a very low false positive and a very low false negative rate, and obviously high sensitivity and high specificity. And then the question is, Okay, so one thing is biomarkers. They could be potentially only surrogate biomarkers, so they are correlating, for example, with the risk to develop delirium or with the delirium development itself, or they could be actually functionally involved and directly related to the pathogenesis of delirium and not only in a surrogate marker. So the question is then obviously, what are we going to study? Is blood really a great way to study something that happens in the brain? Or will we find only things that are surrogates and correlating but really not functionally relevant? Or should we use CSF, which is obviously physically closer to the source of where we believe delirium develops, but that's obviously not necessarily a practical way if you're thinking now about potential long-term clinical applications and not only a research study. Then the question is, what type of biomarkers might be interesting for studying delirium? So again, we have multiple different type of biomarkers we might identify, such as risk markers. So these would be markers that would be increased or decreased prior to the development of delirium, so pre-surgery, and may inform us who has an increased risk of developing delirium post-operative. So these would be very interesting if you want to potentially treat a patient with something that will reduce the risk of developing delirium. Then we could look for, in a way, disease markers. So these would be markers that would be more related to monitoring delirium once it develops. So this could show us when delirium appears and when it disappears again, when it resolves. So this could say, okay, a protein goes up, a protein goes down, and it directly correlates with the timing and severity of delirium. And then you could have prognostic markers, which would be more for long-term consequence, such as potential cognitive decline that would be long-term, and maybe even Alzheimer or other potential long-term outcomes, frailty, or who knows what might happen due to the delirium. And so there are multiple different markers that we can look at, and we would expect them potentially at different times to be increased or decreased. And so the question also, and that I mentioned already, what could we look? So we can look at proteins, DNA, RNA, lipids, metabolites, cells themselves, etc., etc. So there are many different ways to look at. And I will focus first of all now on proteins, because that's the one where we have put most of our effort so far, even so we have planned and we have started some of the other studies as well. So if you're thinking about protein biomarkers, so the question first of all, because we discussed in the SAGE study that we collected plasma, so why are we interested in plasma and not other things? Maybe we can take some biopsies somewhere or whatever. So the key thing is obviously plasma or serum, it's minimally invasive. So it's it's easily collected. It's the one that's most frequently being used in all the different type of diagnostic tests that are currently in the clinic. So it's really, everyone knows how to use serum or plasma. Everyone knows what type of things you can measure. Assays are available. So it's really, from that point of view, it's a very practical way of doing it. And you can obviously collect multiple samples without really interfering with the health of the patient and leading to any kind of increased risk. Then also, it has a good representation not only of proteins that are being released by immune cells, but proteins being released by all different type of cells, tissues, organs in the body. We know obviously you have a lot of liver derived proteins, etc., but we find also proteins that come from the brain. So we have a good representation of all different kind of proteins coming from all different types of sources. And there are also potential then for developing maybe some kind of point of care approaches where we can in the future maybe, I mean maybe not for delirium, that's not so relevant, but for a lot of disease we could also do some diagnostics at home, and we use already these kind of things for if you want to do any kind of measurements for diabetes, etc. So it's really something very practical. But CSF obviously may be more informative, but it's obviously not something that you would do on a routine basis and so on. But that's why often all our follow-up studies now, we include also CSF to compare to plasma, so that we can actually see, do we find proteins that are changing with regard to delirium in CSF? Can we identify the same proteins and the same type of changes also in plasma, or do we see very different profiles of proteins?
We don't know for sure that CSF is more likely to have...
No, we don't know for sure. It's only sort of a hypothesis based on if you assume that most of the things related to delirium development occur due to changes in the brain, that would be sort of the assumption, and then would expect that the proteins that are released by neurons or glial cells or whatever it might be more enriched in the CSF than in the plasma. But again, since we don't know exactly the pathophysiology of delirium, we don't know where does it start or what really triggers it, so it's not necessarily a correct assumption. So we using a number of different types of approaches to look at proteins. One way is to look at target proteomics. So that's based on, we have some kind of a hypothesis, some gut feeling or whatever it might be, or reading the literature and say, okay, maybe this protein or that protein might be relevant for delirium. Why don't we look at it now? And it's either yes or no once we have done the analysis. And then there's the untargeted approach where we would say, okay, we don't know anything. Let's look at everything or as many things as the technology can analyze, and then based on what we see, looking at 100 or 1,000 or a million different things, we'll find out which of these proteins or RNA or DNA or whatever you're looking at show any association with delirium. So these are very different approaches. So one is a hypothesis-driven approach, and the other one is sort of what typically a reviewer in an NIH study section might call a fishing experiment. But it's really nowadays, you know, both approaches obviously work, and more obviously nowadays with all the omics strategies and all the technologies that have been developed, it's really highly successful to start with a more unbiased approach. But we Sage's team had started with target proteomics using actually first of all the Luminex platform to look at a cytokine panel in order to determine whether or not any cytokines might be involved in delirium development, based on the hypothesis that inflammatory processes may trigger or may be involved in delirium development and progression. And that study was published, and just sort of the study design was looking at these matched case control samples, and they were divided into two different groups. One was a discovery cohort of 39 matched pairs, and the other one was the replication cohort of 36 pairs. And as you can see, all the like age, family, etc., a lot of the things are very similar in both cohorts, but there was some discrepancy between the gastrointestinal, the surgeries where you had a significant higher percentage of them occurring in the replication cohort, and also vascular comorbidity was higher in the replication cohort. And then we also actually analyzed, when we combined all of them, what we call the pooled cohort. So when these cytokines were analyzed on the Luminex platform, out of a number of them, actually two of them showed a significant association with delirium. One was interleukin-2 and the other one was interleukin-6. But there was a significant difference the way they were associated with delirium, whereas IL-2 was increased, but was increased at every time point, so it didn't really change. And IL-6 showed only high significant post-surgery, but not before surgery, and again was back to base level 1 month after surgery. So we had clearly one cytokine that seems to be elevated in people developing delirium, but doesn't really change with or without surgery, and one cytokine, IL-6, that shows a correlation with post-surgery and delirium. And they were highly significant, in particular at post-operative day 2. So this was the first study that was published using a targeted approach and clearly shows that indeed proteins can be identified, and obviously IL-6 is a pro-inflammatory cytokine, so it fits also well into the hypothesis about how inflammation or neuroinflammation processes may be involved in delirium development. So then we started with an untargeted proteomics approach. So instead of using ELISA or Luminex, we started actually with a mass spectrometric approach, and again in 2016 we published a paper in Biologic Psychiatry, and another paper is now under review using the mass spectrometric approach. So in the mass spectrometry approach, you do a little bit different, because that's an unbiased way. We don't know what we identify, so we take the plasma. In this case we did a quantitative proteomics approach where we actually tag each sample with a different molecular weight tag, and then we can combine actually 8 samples together for the mass spec analysis, so we can do relative quantitation of one sample versus the other. And then we use this mass spectrometer, and you end up with picking all different kind of proteins that are selected by the mass spectrometer in a way that it looks at the proteins or the peptides that have the highest abundance. So the more of a protein you have, the more likely you will be able to identify it with the mass spectrometer. On the other hand, the lower the concentration of a protein is, the less likely it is that you will detect it using a mass spectrometer. So one problem, let's say the advantage is it's unbiased. Whatever the mass spectrometer can detect, we will find, and we can see if there's any difference. The disadvantage is we will never see interleukin-6 or interleukin-2 because they're too low abundant to be detected by a mass spectrometer. So we're missing a lot of things, potentially interesting things, but we can identify things that we couldn't think about. And the first protein that we identified as being highly significant was actually CRP, that showed up as being increased at both before surgery as well as on post-operative day 2, and was actually then pretty much back, or at least not significant from statistical point of view, 1 month after surgery. And the mass spectrometry approach is a very tedious approach, so we really cannot do it in a high throughput, we cannot do it with hundreds of samples, so it's more a discovery approach rather than an approach where we can go across the whole cohort. So in order to really determine whether or not CRP, as well as several other proteins that we identified, is indeed increased before surgery or after surgery in patients who developed delirium. We then used ELISA validation of CRP, and obviously again CRP is an acute phase pro-inflammatory protein. And what we indeed saw is in both the discovery as well as the replication cohort, or when we combined them into the so-called pooled cohort, that we had statistical significance for both before surgery as well as PACU and postoperative day two. So the mass spectrometric approach allowed us to identify actually CRP as a protein that not only induced due to surgery or at a higher level in patients developing delirium, but actually it was already elevated in patients at risk of developing delirium. So it's not like IL-6, a factor that only monitors delirium development, but also is a potential risk factor for delirium development, indicating that there's probably some kind of a pre-inflammatory state in patients who are at high risk to develop delirium. And in the meanwhile, we have actually further validated CRP across the whole cohort of 560 patients, and it further validated that actually the smaller set of matched case control samples reflects very well the overall patient cohort. So statistical significance was very similar when we looked at the whole patient cohort. And this just shows, so this is actually shown here, where CRP not only was related to delirium incidence, but also was increased and correlating with delirium duration and also severity based on the CAM-S analysis. So the higher CRP levels are, the more likely you will develop delirium, you will have longer duration, and your CAM-S score is also significantly increased. So let me skip this. So the mass spectrometric approach indeed enabled us to identify CRP, and we have identified several other proteins, and that manuscript, as I said, is under review right now. So it is a good approach to identify potential biomarkers, but we don't know what we're missing there. And as I said, it detects more the abundant proteins, but not the low abundant proteins. And the problem overall with biomarkers is really that we have, let's say, a tissue or cells, so let's say the brain, the liver, the kidney, the whatever, releasing proteins into the circulation, and then we get heavily diluted with all the generic blood proteins such as albumin, immunoglobulin, apolipoprotein, protein, and so on. And so we have sort of a challenge of how can we get to these more low abundant proteins? Because the abundant proteins may be interesting, some of them might change also, but they may not be the most interesting and most specific biomarkers. And we know, so we identify IL-6, that's great, but IL-6 has been involved in many other diseases, phenotypes. The same thing with CRP. CRP is measured almost everywhere and is involved in inflammation and cardiovascular disease, etc., etc. So it's interesting and still highly relevant, but it's again not the most specific protein. So how can we get to more specificity? And this just shows you also what is really the levels of different types of proteins in plasma. And we have an issue that there are 12 to 13 logs of differences in protein expression in plasma. So we have on the left side albumin, immunoglobulin, complement, apolipoprotein, and so on, as very, very high abundant. But then if you go to the right side, where you go then to the low picogram from L levels. Then we have, for example, on the red arrow on the right is for interleukin 6 itself. So there's no way it will detect it with mass spectrometry. Or PSA, which is another diagnostic marker, is again below the level of most mass spectrometers. So we have mass spectrometry that can cover typically 3 to 4 logs if you do a lot of depletion of abundant proteins. So there are various methods that are tedious, but you can do it. Then you can maybe get to 5, 6 logs, but you cannot get to 10, 11, 12 logs. So mass spectrometry is okay, but cannot really help us with potentially identifying the best and most interesting biomarkers. So how do we measure really simultaneously all these broad range of low abundant proteins? And we have been looking for many years for a platform that can do it, and then there was this company, SomaLogic, coming up with a new technology a couple of years ago, which is called SomaScan. So what is this platform? So it's a platform that's not using mass spectrometry, it's not using antibodies, but it is using something what is called an aptamer. Does anyone know what an aptamer is? Probably no. Or maybe there are a few people. So aptamer are actually single-stranded DNA oligonucleotides, and they form three-dimensional structures similar to an antibody. And they can bind with very high affinity, specificity, and selectivity to proteins similar to antibodies, and have actually affinities that are as good or better than monoclonal antibodies. And this company actually further chemically modified them so that they can bind even with higher affinity than a standard aptamer. Then the additional advantage of these aptamers is that because they are single-stranded oligonucleotides, they not only can, in this case, be used for binding to proteins, but they can also be used similar like you would use DNA in many other ways. So the detection methods could be PCR, sequencing, microarray, any kind of platform that can detect DNA can detect also aptamers. So you have in a way a bifunctional molecule that on one hand can bind to proteins like an antibody and can be detected with all the highly sensitive methods that can detect DNA. And what they did really, they developed this platform where they generated aptamers against, in this case, 1,305 different proteins. So that's a lot. And the way you do that really is you take a protein, you immobilize it, so a pure protein, and then you run trillions of different aptamers, random sequences through, and you see what binds, and you wash away everything that doesn't bind, and you repeat that multiple times until you get something that has high affinity, and then you demonstrate that it binds only to this protein but not other proteins. And once you do that with all these, for example, 1,305 proteins, you end up with a mixture of aptamers where each aptamer binds to only one protein. And then they put that all together into one platform. And I don't want to go into the details of how it works, but you end up with a platform where for every sample now we can analyze 1,305 proteins simultaneously. But the nice thing in this case is also that it's highly sensitive, so and it goes across the whole dynamic range. So we can actually measure both albumin and interleukin 6, which are on the extremes of protein expression in plasma. We can measure them all together at the same time and get highly quantitative values for both albumin and IL-6, as well as the other 1,300 proteins. So that's great. There's no other technology right now. You can take Luminex or ELISA, and we can get actually very sensitive, but we can only look at one or a few proteins, or we can take mass spectrometry where we can get a lot of proteins but only abundant proteins. In this case, it gets both low and high abundant proteins and many proteins at the same time. We can run a lot of samples through at the same time. So we can, for example, do 100 samples in one go. No problem, it takes us 2 days to do that. And we need very little starting material. So we need, for example, 65 microliter of serum or plasma, which is again as much as you need for ELISA for one single protein. And we can measure over 1300 proteins with the same amount. So we need very little material. You can do it with CSF or urine or what a tissue or whatever you want. And the CVs are actually great. They're around 5%. So what can you really do with this platform? And I just want to give you an example. So one example is here, or it's a question actually. So if you collect blood from each of you now over a period of time, let's say today and a year later, is actually the profile of your proteins in plasma, is it similar or very different? Because if it varies so much from one day to the other, from one year to the other, then the problem might be it might be difficult to find a biomarker. And that hasn't been really analyzed before. This shows actually where we had plasma from healthy people collected over a period of 1 year. And when we take them, so this were 41 or 42 different people, where we had baseline and 1 year later blood collected. And when you then take all these people, the samples from all the people together and all the proteins, and that just the software analyzing how related the different samples are to each other. So every column is a patient sample and every row is a protein, and I just show you a few out of the 1305, so I cannot show you all of them. But what happens then that all the samples from the same patients, always a 0 and 1 year samples, always cluster together. And every person separates from every other person. You always see like two samples clustering together. And they are always from the same person, 0 and 1 year. So what does that tell us? First of all, it tells us that indeed proteins in your blood, the overall profile doesn't really change, but also that every person actually has their own fingerprint of proteins in the blood. And this makes it then very interesting because we could use it then really to further analyze all different kinds of things because it contains all the typical diagnostic markers. And it also allows us really to see what might be different and can we identify then markers for delirium, etc. Similar when we just do something simple, what about BMI? Can we test that? So here we have three low BMI, overweight and obese, and indeed we can nicely separate based on BMI and leptin, as well as CRP and soluble TNF receptor. Some markers of BMI show up nicely to increase based on BMI. So we can do gender, we can do a lot of different things, age and so on. All of them work very well. So we know we have a lot of information there and we can get very accurate data. Similarly, when we do just take the people from the SAGES study before and after surgery, again, we get very nice separation before and after surgery, and again, the typical markers that you would expect to show up due to surgery effect, like inflammatory markers, are indeed highly upregulated. So how about now, can we apply it for delirium? So the study we had when we started out was where we had 12 matched pairs of patients with and without delirium, and we looked at pre-op and post-operative day 2 samples, and indeed we can nicely separate, you can see on the left side, we can nicely separate the controls from the delirium and before surgery from after surgery. And this just shows you another way of demonstrating that using either hierarchical clustering or principal component analysis. Again, you have no delirium from here separating nicely, and when you do a principal component analysis, you get actually a 92% accuracy in separating people with and without delirium. And this is here before surgery. So it means this platform enables us actually to identify risk factors for delirium. We have the same thing also for after surgery, but even before surgery, when they haven't done anything yet, we don't know, or right now we don't know who is most likely to develop delirium, we can identify actually a set of proteins that nicely discriminates between people who will or who will not develop delirium after the surgery. And similar, we have done now things using metabolomics and lipidomics, and I don't want to go into detail, but metabolomics and lipidomics are using mass spectrometric approaches where we can look at hundreds or thousands of different lipids and or metabolites. And again, here you have, in this case, postoperative day two for metabolites. We have 11 metabolites here that discriminate between people after surgery who develop delirium versus no delirium, or lipids both before surgery and after surgery, where we separate again delirium cases from no delirium cases. Again, on whatever omics platform we use, we can actually identify candidates that separate, and we can then further validate in the larger cohort. And the same thing we can do using single cell immunophenotyping. I don't want to go into detail because we ran out of time, but we can look at single cells and look at about 40 different proteins, cell surface markers, as well as intracellular proteins, and even phosphorylation events of proteins within immune cells, and can look at millions of individual cells and see how they change either, or how they are different before surgery, or how they might change after surgery, and show differences between delirium and no delirium. So at the end, I believe that what will happen really, that we will end up with a multimodal panel of biomarkers that will include, for example, DNA, RNA, protein, metabolites, lipids, as well as cells themselves. And then the combination of it, we can then integrate with, and I didn't have time to get into systems biology, but we can integrate it with all the complex type of data we have now available to actually understand the pathophysiology. And at least based on what we have found so far, inflammatory processes clearly play a significant role, not only in delirium itself when it occurs, but also prior to delirium development. And at the end, it will probably be something like this in the future. We will have a chip, and it could be, again, most likely this, what I call a multimodal. So you will look at probably RNA, DNA, protein, or whatever on the same chip altogether. And there are some technologies that can do that already. And you will have multiple different areas, or all different, it could be thousands, it could be millions of things, I don't know.